Hyvää päivää. Tervetuloa tähän Martti Karin väitöskirjan tarkastustilaisuuteen. Väitöskirja käsittelee kyberturvallisuusasioita. Welcome our opponents, Karolina Penrin Pallin and Martti Saarelainen. I will open this public examination of the this.
Arvoisa kustos, kunnioitut vastaväittäjät, hyvät kuulijat, distinguished kustos, honored opponents, ladies and gentlemen. Viime kesäkuussa Yhdysvallat myönsi, että se on toteuttanut vuodesta 2012 alkaen kybertietoverkkotiedustelua Venäjän sähköverkoissa ja valmistellut kyberhyökkäyksiä asetamalla haittaohjelmia Venäjän tietoverkkoihin. Presidentti Putinin lehdistösihteerin Dmitri Peskovin mukaan Venäjä on jatkuvien kyberhyökkäysten kohteena ja Venäjä käy jatkuvaa kamppailua estääkseen näiden hyökkäysten aiheuttamat vahingot. Ulkovaltojen tiedustelupalvelut yrittävät tunkeutua Venäjän tietoverkkoihin, erityisesti logistiikka, pankki- ja energiasektoreilla. Kyberympäristöä on käytetty 2000-luvun alusta alkaen ulko- ja voimapolitiikan alueena. Viron pronssoturikiistassa keväällä 2007 Viron valtionhallintoa ja pankkitoimintaa häirittiin palveluksenestohyökkäyksillä. Stuxnet isku Iranin ydinrikastamoon vuonna 2010 vastasi vaikutuksiltaan lentokoneella tai ohjuksella tehtyä iskua. Kiristyshaittaohjelmaksi naamioitu NotPet ja lamautti suuren osan Ukrainan hallintoa ja yhteiskunnan toimintoja vuonna 2017 ja aiheutti ympäri Eurooppaa yli 10 miljardin dollarin vahingot. Naton huippukokous totesi vuonna 2014, että kyberhyökkäys Naton jäsenmaahan voi laukaista artikla 5 mukaiset vastatoimet, eli käynnistää kollektiivisen puolustuksen. Vuonna 2016 Nato määritteli kybertoimintaympäristön maa-, meri- ja ilmaulottuvuuteen rinnastettavaksi sodankäynnin alueeksi, jossa Naton on kyettävä puolustamaan itseään. Venäläisen määritelmän mukaan informaatiotila on toimintaympäristö, joka liittyy informaation muodostamiseen, muokkaamiseen, välittämiseen, käyttöön tai säilyttämiseen. Venäläinen etuliiteinformaatio sisältää teknisen ja psykologisen osan. Informaatioturvallisuus käsittää suojautumisen ja sekä informaatioteknisiä että psykologisia uhkia vastaan. Informaatiopsykologin uhka kohdistuu ihmisen mieleen, tämän moraaliseen ja henkiseen maailmaan, sosiaalipoliittiseen ja psykologiseen suuntautuneisuuteen ja kykyyn tehdä päätöksiä. Informaatiotekninen uhka kohdistuu taas informaatioteknisiin järjestelmiin, eli kyberympäristöön, ja vastaa meidän länsimaista käsitystä kyberuhka. Perinteisen kriisin uhkakuva ei sovellu kybertilan uhkien kuvaamiseen. Uhkan laatu ja uhkaajan motiivit kybertilassa ovat moninaisemmat ja vaikeammin tunnistettavat kuin esimerkiksi valtion välisissä perinteisissä konflikteissa. Suuri osa kyberuhkaa tuottavista toimijoista, erityisesti rauhan aikana, on ei-valtiollisia toimijoita tai ainakin hyökkääjä on vaikea tunnistaa valtiolliseksi toimijaksi. Ei-valtiolliset toimijat käyttävät samanlaisia taktiikoita, tekniikoita ja menetelmiä kuin valtiolliset toimijat. Kyberhyökkäyksen ja kybertiedustelun ensisijaisen kohteen hahmottaminen voi olla kuulustajalle vaikeaa. Hyökkäjän roolia ja tavoitteita ei välttämättä saada helposti selville. Kybertilan uhki ja voimankäyttöön liittyvä kansainvälinen sopimus ja tapaoikeus on vasta muotoutumassa. Kybertoimintaympäristön merkityksen kasvu kansainvälisen politiikan ja voimankäytön areenana on lisääntynyt huomattavasti. Tämä ja kyberuhkien edellä kuvatut ominaispiirteet ovat lisänneet tarvetta tutkia ja arvioida tieteellisesti valtioiden kyberuhkakuvia ja reagointia kyberuhkiin. Venäjän kyberuhka kuvastaa Venäjän puolustuksellista kybersuorituskyvystä on julkaistu vain vähän tieteellistä tutkimusta. Siksi tutkin väitöskirjassani Russian Strategic Culture in Cyberspace Venäjän kyberuhkakuvaa ja Venäjän keinoja torjua tätä kyberuhkaa. Lisäksi osoitan, että strategisen kulttuurin teoria sopii teoriaksi selittämään ja tulkitsemaan Venäjän kokemaa kyberuhkaa ja reagointia tähän uhkaan. Venäjällä julkaistussa virallisissa asiakirjoissa on riittävästi informaatiota, jotta on mahdollista muodostaa malli Venäjän kokemasta kyberuhkasta ja Venäjän vastauksesta kyberuhkaan. Venäjän Näitä asiakirjoja ovat esimerkiksi strategiat, doktriinit, lait, lakiluonnokset, presidentin asetukset ja eri turvallisuusviranomaisten ohjausasiakirjat. Tutkimuksen lähteissä oli yli 140 virallista venäläistä asiakirjaa vuosista 1995-2019. Pidän näitä Venäjän kyberturvallisuuteen liittyviä asiakirjoja luotettavina lähteinä. Venäläisten viranomaisen täytyy sekä kuvata kyberuhka että antaa kyberuhkan torjumiseksi Venäjän yhteiskunnalle, liike-elämälle ja kansalaisille tiedot riittävän realistisesti. Vaikka yhdestäkään asiakirjasta ei löydy koko kyberuhkakuvaa, on uhkakuva mahdollista koota järjestelmällisellä tutkimuksella. Venäläiset kuvaavat kyberuhkan kohteet, uhkan aiheuttajien ja tämän käyttämät menetelmät samansuuntaisesti kaikissa tutkimukseni aineistoon kuuluvissa asiakirjoissa. Julkiset asiakirjat antavat perusteet kyberuhkalta suojautumiselle koko Venäjän yhteiskunnalle, joten asiakirjoista koottu uhkakuva ei voi poiketa paljon todellisesta kyberuhkakuvasta. Väitöskirjaan sisältyy 6 vertaisarvioitua artikkelia. Näistä 5 on esitetty vuosina 2017-2019 pidetyissä kansainvälisissä kybersodan ja kyberturvallisuuden konferensseissa ja 1 lehdessä Journal of Strategic Studies. Ensimmäisen artikkelin kirjoitin yhdessä ohjaajan Rauno Kuusiston, viimeisen yhdessä ohjaajani Katri Pynnöniemen kanssa. Tutkimuskysymykseni ovat, mikä on Venäjän kyberuhkakuva? Mitkä ovat tärkeimmät suojattavat kohteet Venäjän kyberuhkakuvan mukaan? Miten Venäjä vastaa kyberuhkiin? Ja miten strategisen kulttuurin teorialla voidaan selittää Venäjän kokemaa kyberuhkaa ja miten Venäjä vastaa kyberuhkiin? Venäjän federaation kohdistuva kyberuhka, cyber threat, tarkoittaa väitöskirjassani niitä toimintoja ja toimijoita, jotka aiheuttavat haittaa, vaaran tunnetta tai todellista vaaraa Venäjän federaation eduille kybertoimintaympäristössä tai kybertoimintaympäristön kautta. Kybertoimintaympäristö, cyberspace, tarkoittaa sitä teknologista infrastruktuuria, joka mahdollistaa internetin ja muiden telekommunikaatiokanavien toiminnan ja niiden kautta tapahtuvan toiminnan. Uhkakuva tai uhkakäsitys, threat perception, on ymmärtämisen ja toiminnan pohjana oleva yhteinen tietoisuus ja käsitys uhkasta. Venäjän vastaus kyberuhkaan tarkoittaa Venäjän valtion ja sen viranomaisten toimenpiteitä ennustaa, tunnistaa, estää ja torjua Venäjän federaation kohdistuvia kyberuhkia ja lieventää niitä mahdollisia seurauksia. Tutkimukseni ensimmäisessä vaiheessa rakensin mallin Venäjän kokemasta kyberuhkasta ja tämän uhkan torjunnasta. Käytin datan luokitteluun ja kyseisen uhkamallin rakentamiseen ankkuroitua teoriaa, englanniksi grounded theory. Grounded theory ei ole nimestään huolimatta teoria, vaan Yhdysvalloissa 1960-luvulla erityisesti sosiaalitieteisiin kehitetty tutkimus- ja analyysimenetelmä. Sosiologit Glaser ja Strauss kehittivät aineistolähtöisen analyysin metodiksi tarkastella systemaattisesti kvalitatiivista dataa, kuten asiakirjoja, tavoitteena on muodostaa tutkimuskohteista malli. Malli tarkoittaa kokoelmaa hyvin määriteltyjä ja kehiteltyjä käsitteitä, jotka ovat suhteessa toisiinsa ja muodostavat yhdessä viitekehyksen, jolla voidaan selittää tai ennustaa tutkittavaa ilmiötä. Grounded theory sopii hyvin menetelmäksi tutkia ilmiötä, josta ei vielä ole olemassa teoreettista ja jäsentynyttä tietoa, mutta josta sellaista tarvitaan esimerkiksi ammatillisen päätöksenteon tueksi tai perustutkimukseksi. Grounded theory soveltuu hyvin sellaiseen tutkimukseen, jossa on tarkoitus luoda uutta tietoa ja rakentaa malli laadullisen aineiston avulla. Olen käyttänyt metodina Straussin ja Korpinin versiota grounded theorista. Straussin versiossa tutkimusongelma määritetään deduktiivisesti etukäteen ja hyväksytään se, että tutkija on perehtynyt aihetta koskevaan teoriakirjallisuuteen. Grounded theory-prosessissa tutkija tunnistaa tekstistä käsitteitä, joista luodaan niin sanotulla aksiaalisella koodauksella kategorioita. Tässä vaiheessa koodaaminen tapahtuu keskeisiksi valittujen elementtien eli näiden akseleiden ympärillä. Tavoitteena on syventää kutakin kategoriaa samalla tapaa, kun yleensäkin analyysissä syvennetään teemoja. Selektiivisellä koodauksella kootaan koko aineiston anti malliksi, eli etsitään aineiston juoni tai punainen lanka. Tähän tutkimuksen ydinkategoriaan liitetään muut kategoriat. Ydinkategoriaksi tutkimukseni muodostui kyberuhkan kohde, johon liittyvät muut datasta nousseet kategoriat. Näitä muita kategorioita ovat kyberuhkan subjekti, eli uhkan aiheuttaja, sekä taktiikat, tekniikat ja menettelytavat, joilla kyberuhkaa aiheutetaan, ja lisäksi toteutuneen uhkan aiheuttamat seuraukset. Kyberuhkalta suojautumisen kategorioksi muotoutuvat kyberpuolustuksen kohde, puolustuksen subjekti eli puolustaja, puolustajan taktiikat, tekniikat ja menettelytavat ja kyberpuolustuksen toteuttamista rajoittavat ja estävät tekijät. Venäjän kyberuhkakuvassa Venäjä on Yhdysvaltoja sen johtamien länsimaiden uhkaama ja ympäröimä piiritetty linnake. Uhka on lisääntymässä ja monimuotoistumassa ja uhkaa muodostavat myös terroristit ja ääriliikkeet. Kyberuhkan kohteena ovat Venäjän strategisen tasan intressit, kuten alueellinen koskemattomuus, poliittinen suvereniteetti, vallitsevan poliittisen järjestelmän säilyttäminen. Toinen kohde on informaatio, kolmas kohde on informaatioinfrastruktuuri ja neljäs kohdekokonaisuus Venäjän asevoimat. Kybertoimintaympäristön muuttuminen sotilaalliseksi operaatioalueeksi muodostaa strategista uhkaa Venäjälle ja laajakin kyberoperaatiota toteutetaan jo rauhan aikana. Länsimaat käyttävät teknistä ylivalta-asemaansa kybertoimintaympäristössä ja lännen kyberaseen kehittäminen ja sotaan valmistautuminen saattaa johtaa asevarustelukilpailuun. Länsimaiset tiedustelupalvelut tunkeutuvat venäläisiin tietojärjestelmiin tavoitteena tiedustelu tai ja tiedon manipuloiminen, muuttaminen ja tuhoaminen. Tiedon saatavuuteen vaikutetaan palveluksenestohyökkäyksillä. Teollisuuden automatisoidut ohjausjärjestelmät ovat kyberhyökkäyksen kohteena ja esineiden internet lisää Venäjänkin riippuvuutta tietoverkoista ja haavoittuvuutta kyberhyökkäyksille. Venäjän teknologinen jälkeenjääneisyys nähtiin jo vuoden 2000 informaatioturvallisuuden doktriinissa uhkaksi Venäjän kansalliselle turvallisuudelle. Sama huoli toistui vuoden 2016 doktriinissa. Valtiollinen hyökkäjä pyrkii keräämään Venäjän asevoimista tiedustelutietoja kohteena erityisesti operatiiviset suunnitelmat, ydinasejoukot, ilma- ja avaruuspuolustus, ohjus- ja ohjustontorjuntajärjestelmät. Venäjän asevoimien toiminnan lamauttamista kyberhyökkäyksellä valmistellaan jo rauhan aikana, kohteena erityisesti liikekannallepano ja joukkojen strateginen ryhmittäminen. Venäjä pyrkii vastaamaan kyberuhkiin usealla eri tavalla. Venäjän toimenpiteitä kyberuhkiin uhkan torjumiselle on kriittisen informaatioinfrastruktuurin suojaaminen, valmistelut venäläisen segmentin irrottamista globaalista internetistä, internetin venäläisen segmentin yhä tehostuneempi valvonta, haitallisten verkkosivujen käytön estäminen, tietoverkkojen käytön anonymiteetin kielto, pyrkimys korvata ulkomailta tuodut tieto- ja viestintätekniikat venäläisvalmisteisilla tuotteilla ja pyrkimys saada aikaa voimankäyttöä kyberympäristössä säätelevä kansainvälinen sopimusjärjestelmä, joka tunnustaa valtion oikeuden hallita omalla alueellaan olevaa internettiä täysin. Tutkimukseni toisessa vaiheessa tunnistin strategisen kulttuurin teorian avulla Venäjän johdon strategiseen ajatteluun vaikuttavia tekijöitä ja sitä, miten tämä näkyy käytännössä. Strateginen kulttuuri tarkoittaa valtion, käytännössä valtion johdon, näkemyksiä kriisin luonteesta, valtion kohdistuvasta uhkasta ja uhkan aiheuttajista sekä vaihtoehdosta vastata näihin uhkiin. Yhdysvalloissa 1970-luvulla kansainvälisen politiikan teoriana syntynyt strategisen kulttuurin teoria pyrkii tunnistamaan valtion strategiseen kulttuuriin vaikuttavia tekijöitä ja selvittämään, miten ja mihin nämä tekijät vaikuttavat. Strategisen kulttuurin kehittäjä Jack L. Snyder pyrki määrittelemään Neuvostoliiton strategista päätöksentekoa ohjaavat asenteet ja niihin vaikuttavat tekijät. Snyderin jälkeen strategisen kulttuurin teoria on kehittynyt neljän sukupolven ajan. Ensimmäisen sukupolven edustaja professori Colin Grain mukaan oli vaarallista olettaa, että Neuvostoliiton uhkakuva ja päätöksentekoprosessi oli samanlainen kuin Yhdysvalloissa. Toinen sukupolvi, joka keskittyi strategisen kulttuurin ja valtiokäyttäytymisen väliseen suhteeseen, arvioi, että demokraattisesti hallittu Yhdysvallat on kyvyttömämpi toimimaan strategisesti kuin sotilaallisesti orientoitunut totalitaarinen Neuvostoliitto. Tämä arvio osoittautui vääräksi Neuvostoliiton romahtaessa. 1990-luvun alussa konstruktivismi syrjäytti neorealismin ja neoliberalismin kansainvälisen suhteiden ja kansainvälisen politiikan tutkimuksen teoriana. Samalla strategisen kulttuurin tutkimus laajeni myös muun kuin ydinsodan tutkimukseen. Kolmannen sukupolven edustaja Alastair Ian Johnson tutki 1990-luvun alussa kiinalaisen strategian, kulttuurin ja voimankäytön suhdetta. Johnstonin mukaan valtion strateginen kulttuuri koostuu keskeisestä paradigmasta, eli ajattelutavasta ja preferensseistä, eli strategista vaihtoehdoista. Paradigma tarkoittaa käsitystä konfliktin luonteesta, vastustajasta ja uhkasta. Strategiset vaihtoehdot tarkoittavat keinoja torjua uhkaa. Neljäs sukupolvi pyrkii tunnistamaan strategisen kulttuurin sisällä toista kanssa kilpailevia alakulttuureita ja arvioimaan alakulttuurien erilaisia strategisia vaihtoehtoja. Vaikka Johnstonin analyyttinen kehys on melkein 25 vuotta vanha, valitsin sen väitöskirjani teoriaksi, koska Johnstonin lähestymistapa on edelleen voimassa. Strategisen kulttuurin jako keskeiseen paradigmaan ja preferensseihin tarjoaa puitteet selittää Venäjän kyberuhkakuvaa ja reagointia kyberuhkiin. Paradigma, eli keskeinen ajattelutapa, on Venäjän uhkakuva. Strategiset vaihtoehdot, eli preferenssit, vastaavat Venäjän toimenpiteitä torjua tätä uhkaa. Venäläiseen strategiseen kulttuuriin vaikuttavat historialliset ja maantieteelliset tekijät, Venäjän teknologinen jälkeenjääneisyys ja maan poliittinen järjestelmä sekä muuttunut sodankuva. Mongolien, Napoleonin ja Saksan kahdessa maailmansodassa tekemät maahantunkeutumiset ovat luoneet venäläisessä haavoittuvuuden tunnetta ja yllätyshyökkäyksen pelkoa. Teknologinen jälkeenjääneisyys ja helposti puolustettavien rajojen puute erityisesti Euroopan suunnassa lisää haavoittuvuuden tunnetta ja yllätyshyökkäyksen pelkoa. Venäjän johto kuvaa Venäjän olevan jatkuvassa sodassa oleva piiritetty linnake, ja sodankäynti sen eri muodossa nähdään von Clausewitzin mukaisesti politiikan jatkeena. Sisäinen oppositio, jota venäläisnarratiivin mukaan länsimaiset tiedustelupalvelut ohjaavat ja rahoittavat, aiheuttaa sisäisen uhkan tunnetta. Ulkoinen ja sisäinen uhka sekä suurelta osin voimaministeriöihin nojaava poliittinen järjestelmä ovat lisänneet edelleen asevoimien ja turvallisuuspalvelun merkitystä. Tutkimuksen kolmannessa vaiheessa selitän Venäjän kyberuhkakuvaa ja sitä, miten Venäjä vastaa näihin uhkiin strategisen kulttuurin teorian avulla. Yllätyshyökkäyksen ja sisäisten vihollisten pelko ja esimerkiksi teknologinen jälkeenjääneisyyden aiheuttama haavoittuvuuden tunne näkyy myös kyberuhkakuvassa. Lännen teknologisen ylivoiman vuoksi Venäjä kokee, että sillä ei ole helposti puolustettavia rajoja myöskään kyberympäristössä. Jatkuvan sodankäynnin narratiivi ja usko voimankäyttöön politiikan tekemisen välineenä näkyy sekä kyberuhkakuvassa että Venäjän keinoissa vastata kokemansa kyberuhkaan. Venäjä on pyrkinyt suojaamaan piiritettyä kyberlinnakettaa luomaan helposti puolustettavia rajoja valmistelevalla internetin venäläisen segmentin eristämistä globaalista internetistä, parantamalla kriittisen informaatioinfrastruktuurin suojaamista ja pyrkimällä esimerkiksi korvaamaan ulkomailta tuotava informaatioteknologia venäläisvalmisteisella. Sisäistä vihollista vastaan taistellaan tehostetulla tietoverkkojen valvonnalla, haitalliseksi luokiteltujen verkkosivujen sulkemisella ja tietoverkkojen käyttäjien tunnistamisella. Venäjän poliittinen johto valmistautui jo vuoden 2021 parlamenttivaaleihin ja 2024 presidentinvaaleihin tai muuten tapahtuvaan johtajanvaihdokseen. Tämän vuoksi opposition mahdollisuuksia käyttää tietoverkkoa vaikeutetaan tehostamalla tietoverkkojen valvontaa, sulkemalla opposition verkkosivuja ja valmistelemalla venäläisen segmentin eristämistä. Tutkimuksen tärkein tulos on havainto, että Johnstonin versiota strategisen kulttuurin teoriasta voidaan käyttää selittämään Venäjän kyberuhkakuvaa ja Venäjän toimenpiteitä kyberuhkan torjumiseksi. Venäläisen strategisen kulttuurin keskeinen paradigma vastaa venäläistä käsitystä kyberuhkan luonteesta, uhkan aiheuttajasta ja sen käyttämistä menetelmistä. Keskeinen paradigma näkyy ylätason asiakirjoissa, kuten doktriineissa ja strategioissa. Strategiset preferenssit eli toimintavaihtoehdot kuvaavat Venäjän keinoja torjua kyberuhkaa, suojattavia kohteita ja kyberpuolustuksen subjekteja eli torjunnan toteuttajia. Vaikka näitä Venäjän viranomaista ja yhteiskunnan käytännön toimia kyberuhkan torjumiseksi on vaikea havainnoida, pystytään nämä strategiset preferenssit löytämään laeista, asetuksista ja eri turvallisuusviraston ohjausasiakirjoista. Mikäli voidaan seurata Venäjän strategisen kulttuurin vaikuttavia tekijöitä ja niiden muutosta, voidaan myös arvioida Venäjän strategisen kulttuurin muutosta myös kyberympäristössä. Strateginen kulttuuri muuttuu hitaasti, joten todennäköistä on, että Venäjä tulee jatkamaan piiritetyn kyberlinnakkeen suojaamista myös jatkossa samalla tavalla kuin se on tehnyt. Honored doctors, as the opponents appointed by the faculty, please present comments that you see my dissertation has given ground for.
Distinguished Kustos and candidate Kari, ladies and gentlemen, most of us are completely ignorant of the technology that makes up cyberspace. And many of us would struggle to define it. In fact, there is no single correct definition of what constitutes cyberspace. The owners of Google once put it, the internet is the first thing that humanity has built that humanity doesn't understand. Cyberspace is even more difficult. While the internet is a technical term, the notion of cyberspace, in my mind, is rooted in the social sciences. This means that cyberspace is defined not only in technical terms, but also in very much human terms. Nowadays, the cyber dimension plays a special and very specific role concerning national threat pictures. This is because everything significant that happens in the real world, including every political and military conflict, will also take place in cyberspace. For national security planners, this includes, for example, cybercrime, propaganda, espionage, influencing, terrorism, and even war itself. The nature of national security threats hasn't changed, but cyberspace provides a new delivery mechanism that can increase the speed, diffusion, and power of an attack and ensure anonymity and asymmetries in vulnerabilities, which means that smaller or weaker actors have more capacity to exercise power in cyberspace than in many other domains in world politics. Martti Kari's thesis on Russian strategic culture in cyberspace provides a very unique and interesting insight into the Russia's official perceptions of the cyber threat it faces and how it responds to that threat. What I would like to hear more today are more conclusions based on your research material. More text interpretation, more looking behind the texts. For example, what is not mentioned in the official texts and why not? I think that we are now ready to move to the more detailed examination and questions. And I start with the first question. As Alex Gilbert, in his book The Darkening Web, mentioned that Russia has rejected the terms cybersecurity and even cyberspace, which Russia maintains are simply false terms at best and evidence of Western plot at worst. Instead, Russia advocates the use of the term information security. The Russian definition of information security reflects the Russians' attempts to legitimize state control over all aspects of information, in particular towards hostile content. And now, in the beginning of this event, I would like to hear more about these terms presented in your research material, the cybersecurity, cyberspace, and information security. You have used the term cyberspace, for example, in your thesis title, although Russia has rejected the term as a Western plot against Russia. Would you describe to us, from Russian point of view, what is the main difference between these terms and how these terms are used in your research material, and why Russia has rejected these cyber space and cybersecurity terms?
Well, thank you. So the Russians are using the word information instead of cyber. And in the Russian vocabulary and in Russian mind, information, whatever information threat or information security or information warfare, it divided in two parts. No, it's not divided in two parts. It consists of two parts. there is an information psychological part, which means that whatever has an effect to our minds or our capability to make decisions and so on, that's an information psychological part. And then Russians speak about the information technological part, which is the mean, how to protect or to influence the minds and decision making of the people. So the Russians, since 1920s, they have realized that the mean and the information itself, they are not separate things. In 1920s, they already established in that time, it was GBU, before the KGB, they established an office called Disinformation Bureau, which task was to infect minds of Western people, you know, by fake news. Even it was not, the fake news as a word was not known in that time. But anyhow, since 1920s, they have had the modus operandi, how they have combined the mean, technical means. In that time, it was newspapers and radio and Sergei Eisenstein's films and the information psychological part. And they have done it very flexible. And they, for example, 2000, they published information security doctrine. And there it was combined, the technical part and the psychological part. If you look what we are here in West doing, we have cyber. It's that equivalent to Russian way of thinking of information technological part of information security and influence. But we don't have, if you ask here, who is taking care of the information psychological part, we don't have, because we have in West, we have two separate things. We have information psychological part and information technological part. But Russians, they have, from the very beginning, they have kept them together. And still, 2016, information doctrine, they are together. They speak how West influence technical systems which are in Russia, or how West is trying to influence the minds of Russian people, starting from religion to whatever. So the Russians are keeping them together. And when I say cyber, I mean information technological part of the whole Russian understanding of information. And they are not using the word cyber. When they speak about what West is doing, then they use the word cyber. When they speak about what Russians are doing, they don't use cyber word usually. They used to have, in 2013, there was a draft of concept of cybersecurity, but it was never accepted as official documentation. So only document which they have, where in the title you have the word cyber, 2013, the draft of the cybersecurity concept. But after that, no, it's always information.
Thank you very much, and distinguished Custis and candidate Carey, thank you for inviting me to act as an opponent. It's a great honor. Thank you. I'm very pleased with the thesis, and so much of the points that I will raise are about teasing out the extras that I think are in the thesis, but sometimes almost a bit hidden. And it's also questions that I think anyone writing on Russian cyber will have to grapple with. And so it's mainly about boring into these questions a bit more thoroughly. My questions will revolve around definitions, actors, and also what I will call elephants in the room, what was referred to here as things that are not in the text but perhaps should be there. But just to continue on this question about cyber and how Russians define information security, in the thesis, you set out to look at the information technical side of information security. But these two very quickly become intermingled when you study Russian cyber. So I would like to hear more about how you defined away certain issues while you kept some. I mean, when you talk about the security of critical information infrastructure, then we're clearly in the cyber domain, so to speak. But then when you talk about efforts to increase surveillance, I would suggest that we're moving to the psychological side of it. It's about controlling content so that it doesn't poison the mind of the population, basically. So I would like to hear more about how you did this distinction, what to include in the thesis and what to exclude. I think these are issues that anyone writing on Russian cyber grapple with. It's difficult. I think you're absolutely right not to include some aspects of information psychological security, while at the same time not including all of it. So a bit more about how you defined away certain aspects and decided to include, for example, surveillance and SORM.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. When I start the work, I thought that, okay, the whole information security is too large topic to discuss in one thesis. So I decided, okay, because I'm from the information technological faculty, I should concentrate more technological questions than psychological questions. And then when I went through all the documentation I had to do, I had to in every document I had to think, okay, that I will include, that I will exclude. And as you said, the drawing the line between psychological and technical issues, it's very challenging. Mm-hmm. And in some parts, especially when I'm speaking about the struggle against the opposition, I as I remember right, I mentioned that even this is information psychological part, I include that because this is done technological way. For example, blocking the opposition or extremist networks and so on. So whenever I include something, I thought, should I include that or not? Mm-hmm. And I thought that I included technical things, and then we went, when we were in a border of technical and psychological things, I mentioned in the text that even this is partly psychological part, I include that because it can be discussed also from the technical point of view. Mm. But for example, the FSB surveillance in the internet, in Russian segment of internet, even its psychological target, how FSB is doing that, it's technical means. They use SORM systems, for example, for surveillance of the network and so on. That's why that is included in my work. Mm-hmm. But you are right, it's challenging to say this is... And now probably I will continue the work and I include that psychological part to this package.
Yes, and I also have, as you say, Russia has a very holistic view of cyber means. It's something that they employ in tandem with military, economic, diplomatic, and whatever means they have at their disposal. But you state at a few places in the thesis and in the article that cyber has been recognized as a new domain of warfare. But the source for this is a NATO document.
Yeah.
And this raises a number of interesting questions to my mind. It seems to imply that cyberspace is something that is studied separately. But it also suggests that a war can take place in cyberspace. And just let me apologize beforehand for this barrage of questions and feel free to pick and choose between them. But first of all, has Russia, in fact, drawn this conclusion that it is a new domain of warfare? Or does Russia think about cyber in this way? Or does it interact with other domains more closely in Russian thinking? Is there, according to Russian sources, an ongoing war in cyberspace? Are criminal attacks part of this war? Or is it perhaps the Russian word "противоборство," battle, that we should use, the word that the Russian MOD uses? Is that more correct? So feel free to choose from these questions.
So I had two components here. We have West NATO, back aggressive NATO, and then we have peace loving Russia over here. And NATO is defining cyber as a fifth environment or fifth domain of warfare. And they are attacking Russia. So even the Russians are not saying that the cyber domain is the fifth domain. They think in that way because the aggressive NATO is considering the cyber as a fifth environment or fifth domain of warfare. And what the Russians are using, they mainly are using the word "противоборство," which is a struggle. But also they are using words which are closer to warfare. And for example, Peskov said that Russian is in temporary war. He said that what is going now in Russia, there is elements of cyber war. Why now? They use the why now word in that. So the Russians are using also the word the war or warfare, but mainly they are using "противоборство," because the Russian way of thinking is different, because the Russians, they don't have war and they don't have peace. They have war and peace, and in the middle there's a "противоборство." So it's a struggle, what they are doing, which we don't understand. We have in Finland, we have war and peace, and we don't understand that between there is a huge area where somebody can operate against us. And Russians use the word "противоборство" because they don't want to say war. So I think that's one reason why they are, you know, using different words than we are doing.
Yes. My next question is on Russian official documents as a valid primary source. You write on page 24 that the Russian official documents related to cybersecurity can be considered reliable and valid primary sources. You continue that even though the detailed cyber threat picture is classified, official documents have to include information close enough to the real classified picture to give realistic enough information to counter the cyber threats. In general, the central government planning processes can be seen as extreme examples of ritualized writing. And as such, they may seem uninteresting as an object of study to anyone interested in more material contents of policies. Large parts of the example of the implementation, for example, remain secret, but I agree that it is still possible that the researcher who solely rely on open and official source material can assess the level, for example, of success of implementation, at least to the some extent. But I would like to hear more about the argumentation in these administrative texts. First, what are the audiences to these texts? And does the argumentation differ depending on audience? Can you estimate how much the writing of these texts, these official documents, are just part of this kind of ritualized process? And then one question still related to this. You write on page 24 that Russian official documents are used by Russian authorities to give guidance to Russian society and people in order to counter these threats. Would you elaborate a little bit more that what kind of guidance these documents give to the people?
Yes, no, first of all, as I wrote, I believe that by checking very carefully all these documents, you are able to build up the Russian cyber threat perception. It's secret, but you are able to collect piece by piece the picture. Well, before I retired, my last job in military was that I was doing the intelligence legislation, Finnish intelligence legislation. And what we did, we had the operational need. The operational people thought that, okay, we want to have that and that kind of mandate. And my job was to translate that mandate, the need, for the legal people who were writing the draft of the law. So in the draft of the law, or in the law, the mandate should be told in that way that it doesn't tell the operational capabilities of our intelligence, but it's well bordered in that way that the lawmakers and the judges realize that what is meant by this sentence or by this paragraph in this law. And when I was sitting in a meeting with our lawyers, and I had our operational people ideas in my mind, I suddenly realized that, okay, this is the way how I can get the Russian secret cyber threat perception also, because they are doing the same way. You can't do the laws in different way. You can't put in a law that beware red buses if you want that people are beware of the green bicycles. And if you don't wrote in one law that beware red buses, but somewhere you can read that, okay, red, and somewhere bus, you get the picture that, okay, they are afraid of red buses. And we had two laws. They have more than 140 documents. So from these documents, you are able to collect the picture much more better than from our laws, for example. So that was understood by doing, because I was doing the same process in our side, and I realized that the Russians, they had to have done the way in the same way, because you had to tell in a law how people had to behave. You can't make a laws just due to bluff the Western intelligence, because then the people are doing the things in the wrong way. So in the laws, the things had to be right, and the guidance documents which are written according to laws by FSB or FSTEC and so on, they give more detailed instructions how to protect your systems or what kind of cyber threats should be afraid of. So I believe that by very careful work, you are able to build up the Russian real cyber threat perception, even if it's not public. And the grounded theory which I used here was excellent tool for that, because it made semi-automatically that picture.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I'll get to my question on actors, because it's very connected, I think, to the documents and the process that through which you arrive at these documents. So I would like to dwell a bit on the question around whose strategic culture is the subject of investigation here, the actors. And in a way, perhaps this is a consequence of the fact that I have a keen interest in decision-making and strategy formation, but I do think that it has a direct bearing on strategic culture, and I hope to get back to that when we discuss the theory more in detail. I agree that the FSB has acquired a very dominating role on these issues at NACA. You described the Russian Security Council quite briefly, but in my view, the Security Council and its apparatus has had a very important role, not least when it comes to the doctrine on information security. The Council itself does not just help determine security policy, it's the formal coordinating council, and the apparatus is a vehicle for drafting policy. I think the process that you were involved in is what takes place in the Security Council. And to add to that also, it's former Deputy Secretary Shestyuk. He's played a very important role, I would argue, in Russia's bid for an international treaty on information security. How would you evaluate the role of the Security Council? Do you think that it's just a vehicle for the FSB or the FSTEC? Is that why you didn't dwell more on the Security Council?
I think that Security Council, it has three roles. Mm-hmm. First of those roles is that
it's drafting a lot of documents. So a lot of strategies or doctrines are drafted by the Security Council or in the Security Council, even it's not published by a Security Council document. It might be published by the UCAS of the president or whatever, but they are drafting because all the people who are somehow related with the security of Russia, they are sitting in that council, and they had to get consensus, some kind of consensus, when they are drafting the documents. That's one thing. And second thing is that it's the board of discussions with and by the president. Mm-hmm. So president who is leading the Security Council, he get touch all the areas of Russian security, it's internal or external security, whatever. And it's also an arena to spread information and so on. And third thing is that the main players, like head of FSB or the Ministry of Defense, they are sitting on it. So three roles, it's drafting board, it's discussing board, and it's the networking and connecting all the leading bosses of security related to Russian security.
Yeah. Could I have one? Yeah. I also have a question about the presidential administration, which is not mentioned in the thesis.
Pardon?
The presidential administration. Yeah. In my view, the presidential administration is important, not least because it's the supreme arbiter. And I would suggest, following your periodization that you make from, you started at page 89. During the first period, 1990 to 2011, government authorities such as FAPSI and the FSB and the Securities Council, they were interested in information security and cybersecurity. And I think you find much of the same language that you find in the documents now. However, I think the presidential administration at the time did not take it very seriously. And following the Arab Spring and the Bolotnaya, the second period that you mentioned in the thesis, they started taking it seriously. And this is when you see things happening in the legislation area. And it's even, I would argue, possible now to see a fourth period with Kirienko taking a keen interest in amassing big data so that he can roll out a new generation of information control over the population. So how did you think about the role of the presidential administration?
I think the role of presidential administration related also with the president. Mm-hmm. Until 2012, Medvedev was a president, and the idea was to digitalize Russia. So during the Medvedev time, Russian approach to internet was more positive. Mm-hmm. So they thought that, okay, it will bring a lot of benefits, economical benefits, for example, for Russia, and they had to digitalize the whole country. Mm-hmm. And they exactly doesn't realize the threat which is included in internet, because even the Arab Spring had started 2011, and a lot of demonstrations were organized and called up by the internet. The Russians not exactly realized the power of internet. President administration also believed that, okay, if we control the media, I mean the television, mm-hmm. radio, and the newspapers, we control the flow of information to people. But the young people, they were more and more following, getting information from internet. And 2012 was some kind of watershed between the old system and the new system. Old system, I mean Medvedev, presidential administration for the digitalization of Russia. And suddenly 2012, when they had Bolotnaya demonstrations against the transit of the power from Medvedev back to Putin, they realized that, okay, we had to take control also over the internet because youngsters are using the internet for getting information. So I think that might be the way of how the presidential administration has, the mindset in the presidential administration has been changed. 2012, mm-hmm. after that, against. Before that, for internet.
Yeah, I would argue that also in 2014 you could see the presidential administration taking an even keener interest, and you can even follow it, I think, through the organizational changes that were made to the administration. That suddenly you had advisors on information security and also a separate department dealing with digitalization.
Yeah exactly. And they, after 2014, they drafted a lot of new documents, for example, security doctrine concept and so on. So and the role of both the Security Council and the President Administration was big in that process.
My next question is on implementation of those laws. You write on page 95 that because the researcher doesn't have insight on the implementation of strategic preferences in practice, this implementation had to be exposed and explained by describing the content of lower-level cyber-related documents. To what degree has the implementation failed? And what do you think, why it happened?
Implementation of what?
Implementation of the laws and these other official documents which should be implemented.
So the way how I built up the model is that, okay, we have a higher level documents like strategies and doctrines. They are telling the central paradigm, how they think, the threat, the enemy. And then we have a lower level documents like laws, a draft of laws. They are sometimes better than laws because in drafts they might be something which they want to get published in laws. And then they have guidance documents by FSB and FSTEC and so on. And there you see the strategic preferences, how they try to implement the defense. You are not able to follow exactly how well and how deeply they are able to implement that. But if you follow the laws and then you follow the guidance documents, and if there will be another guidance document after a year or two related to the same thing, it means that the implementation has not been succeeded. If everything goes fine with the one guidance document, it might tell you that, okay, they have succeeded in that or that or that. And for example, the critical information infrastructure is one very interesting topic to speak, because they started to build up the protection of critical information infrastructure already 2000. And they were able to do that. They got the law concerning protection of critical information infrastructure 2017. And now they have started the implementation. If the production of law took 17 years, probably it takes five years, 10 years to build up the protection in that way that it really works.
Do you find in your research material plans which are made only for political reasons but without any ambition to realize?
No, I think the last law about the isolation of Russian segment of internet, it's somehow political law. It's somehow political law, and the people who are working hands-on with the information security or cybersecurity in Russia, they have publicly announced that the law is made by the people who doesn't understand anything how the internet works. So there is some of the documents are politically orientated, but there is also the practical part. If you think about isolation of internet, Russian segment of internet, they speak about isolation in that way that it should be isolated, like in China with the great China war of all. They are speaking in that way, but in practice they are not planning to do that in a practice, but they are planning to isolate partly isolate the Russian segment of internet still. So there is the political will, and then there is a practical things which are close to political will, and they are so close that political will that they can say that okay, we have implemented this political will, even it's not practical done in that way that it's mentioned in the political level. I hope that I did myself clear. Yes. But it's a new, normal Russian system, you know. Bumaka ja praktika. It means that they have bumaka and then they have praktika. And it has always been there, the system, and it will always be.
In a way, we already got to my elephants by by this question. So I'll invoke Krylov's fable and suggest a few ways of exploring the elephants in the room. In other words, I would like to talk about what is missing in the official documents, even though we know it ought to be there. Because perhaps this tells us something fundamental also about Russian strategic culture. And in fact, I would suggest there are quite a few elephants in Russian cyberspace. Just to explain, for those of you who are not familiar with the Krylov's fable, it's about seeing all the details but missing the big elephant in the room. And I think there are quite a lot of elephants here. So I'm not asking you to diverge from the empirical material and examine what's not there, because you can't do that. But I think sometimes it's important to ask oneself, what is missing when I go through the data? It's impossible to examine non-existent empirical data, but it is possible to note that something is missing. And when it comes to intentions and program documents, there is a significant part of Russia's practice to have grand schemes that are not carried out and that are even at times impossible to realize, to look the other way, so to speak. And you mentioned the law on a sovereign runet, but there are plenty of other examples as well. The Yarova package, it's impossible to implement in full, and everyone knows that, and quite a lot of companies do a lot of money in the process. There are business interests at play as well. Another example would be the demand for all companies to store personal data on Russian territory. Now, this is announced as a measure to protect Russian citizens' privacy. But in fact, there is no provision in the legislation, as far as I see, and I don't see how you could do that. There's no demand for Facebook to erase those data on their own servers. So this is, in fact, about something else. I would suggest that it's about getting big data stored in Russia. So I would like to ask you a bit about the things that you don't see, that you're missing in the legislation, and this practice of looking the other way.
Yeah, I think how to explain that is that we have to understand that, for example, Finland is a rule of law country, which means that we are obeying our laws, and our laws are protecting citizens and so on. And we have a common understanding that this is the law, and this is how we have to behave according to law. That's a rule of law country. Russia is ruled by law, which means that, okay, we have legislation, but the leadership can use the legislation as they want. If they want something, they get it, because they said, this is in a law. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that everything which is in a law should be followed. Mm-hmm. It should be followed in the case if somebody wants to have something. Mm-hmm. And, for example, you mentioned the Yarovaya laws. It says that, okay, if you are a teleoperator, you have to keep all the data. I mean, all the phone calls, all the emails, and everything, 6 months. Mm-hmm. and you had to store all metadata, 3 years. It's in a law. Mm-hmm. One Russian calculate that in the world, whole world, there is not so much storage space to storage the data told in a Yarova laws that it's not possible. It's technically it's not possible, and both knows that. Teleoperators know that, and administration know that. But they can use that Yarova law if they want to get operator in the troubles, or if they want to have money. They said, okay, here we have a law, Yarova law. You have not obeyed the Yarova law. You will be punished. Mm. So that's the Russian system. Rule by law state works in that way. And as you mentioned, Yarova law is one good example of that. Mm-hmm. The isolation of internet is second good example of that. Mm. So we have a law, but you implement that law according your needs when you are in a higher hierarchy.
Yeah.
I think that's one way to explain why they make laws which they are not able to implement totally.
Yeah.
But of course, I think a lot of us has, you know, used the mobile phone when he's driving his car. So also in Finland we have, but not in that scale we have that disobedience. Mm. But in Russia it's much huge.
Yeah. So. Just to mention another elephant that I found. You examine the official view, where the West and the US especially are enemies. At the same time, if you look at what security companies, Russian securities companies say, cyber espionage from China is one of Russia's main problems. It's never mentioned in official texts, but probably China accounts for more cyber attacks than the US and Europe does against Russia. Add to this the dependence that Russia is building up on Chinese electronics and the position of companies like Alibaba in Russia today. Even though Russia exchanges practices with China on how to increase authoritarian control using cyber measures, I would not call this cooperation and an alliance. It's something else. So how could this be captured and explained, do you think, with strategic culture? Is it compatible with Russian strategic culture to simply replace one import dependence with another one? Because that's what they're doing if they're turning to China. And I know the FSB is not happy with that. Is it not the case that a fundamental element of Russian strategic culture is that Russia tends to want to be self-sufficient rather than build true long-lasting alliances?
Yeah, you are right. China is not mentioned as aggressor or opponents of Russia in not even one document.
No.
The documents related to China are either agreements. They established 2009 cyber or information security agreement with China, where they said, okay, we will not spy each other, we will not attack each other in a cyber environment. And that's the only official document where they have mentioned China. Of course, probably, obviously, China is also an enemy, but I would call the relationship with China and Russia as a forced marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to be friends because they have common enemy, United States. So the common enemy combines them, but of course they are watching very carefully what the friend is doing.
Just one more elephant that I'm missing in the thesis. In the West, we discussed the next technological leap, which is 5G. And we're concerned about China. But how will Russia go about introducing this? Because this ought to be something that they discuss in documents and so on. And that the internet companies have recently been denied military frequencies that they were hoping for to develop 5G in Russia. And they say that this is going to delay development of technological development, digital development in Russia for a couple of years. Now, for a country that's concerned about falling behind technologically. I think relatively little is said in official statements and documents about how they're going to go about this next technological leap. What do you have anything on what Russian thinking is on 5G and cybersecurity? Or if there's not, what does this relative silence on the topic suggest about Russia and its strategic culture here?
When we speak about 5G technology, I think Russia is very closely looking what China is doing. Because the Russians, the technological areas which they have, it's dated from the 18th century. They didn't know how to make boats. Peter the Great, he went to Netherlands and learned how to make boats, ships. Stalin wanted to have a nuclear weapon. Russians didn't know how to make a nuclear weapon. They sent a lot of spies or intelligence officers, let's say in a polite way, intelligence officers to West. Bring me information about the nuclear weapon. The Russians were 4 years later, late United States. They had 1949 Hydrock bomb. In 1960s, they want to know what is computer. And they had some computers of their own, but they were not working in a proper way. So they wanted to have a computer. They sent intelligence officers to West, collect information about the computers. They collected IBM computers. They went them to Russia. There was an embargo because of the Afghan war. They had embargo. So they drew Japan because there was Olympics in Tokyo. They through the Tokyo Olympics systems, they get IBM computers. And by reverse engineering, they found out how computers work. They built up their own computers according to the model of IBM, but they were 5 to 10 years late because if you reverse engineering something, produce the same components, build it up, and check does it work or not, you are late. Now, there's two questions. Bring me information about 5G. Bring me information about the artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. They are doing that. And mm-hmm. they are also 5 to 10 years late also in that. Mm-hmm. So if you follow the history of technological capability buildings in Russia, it's related with intelligence mm-hmm. more than, for example, in West. And now they are in a heat. They are collecting information, 5G information and artificial intelligence information.
Okay, my next question is on offensive and defensive relationship in the cyber domain. On page 96, you discuss the Russian offensive cyber capabilities and operations as a possible theme for the further study. You mentioned that one research approach could start with the hypothesis that the objects of cyber threat perception are a mirror image of the targets of Russian offensive cyberspace operations. This is indeed a very interesting finding from the thesis research sources, and it is an example how the researcher can reveal interesting and relevant issues by looking behind the texts. And you mention on page 89 that Russia's methods to respond to cyber threats are first, pivoting to international cybersecurity agreements, secondly, improving the protection of critical information infrastructure, and thirdly, preparing to isolate the Russian segment of internet from the global internet. I know that this is not it's not mentioned in your research material, but do you agree that the fourth method is to weaken the United States and West and therefore raise Russia's own relative power by offensive?
You are right. But what the Russians are doing in the West, they are, for example, if we think 2016, what happened in the United States when they had the elections, when the Russians attacked or collect information in internet, the main target was not internet or cyber related, the target was society. Society. So I excluded this from this work because it was not cyber orientated. It was state orientated activities which they did there. But you are right. They are the fourth way to protect themselves is to push the line of defense.
I mean now more to this further study possibilities.
Yeah.
So that's why I asked.
Because what I found during my study is that you might be able to build up the list of Russian offensive cyber capabilities by watching carefully what are they protected target. For example, in 2006, they had a draft of law concerning the protection of critical information infrastructure, 2006. There was mentioned that the most valuable target to be protected from the attacks from the West is the election system called Vibory. So the Russians said that, okay, 2006, in a draft of law, they said that we should protect our system of elections. In next 2012 draft, the system was not mentioned anymore. It means that between 2006 and 2012, probably they have realized how to protect the election system, and also they might have understood that, okay, that's the target to attack in West, as they did 2016 in the United States, and they have done somewhere else also. So if you follow very carefully the list or the idea what to protect, you are able might be able also to build up the list of targets where they attack. But I haven't. I put that in my book that might be the next topic of research for me or for somebody else.
But you agree now that the offensive part of the Russian cyber politics is part of the defense.
Yes. No. Sure. Yeah. 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 You can interpret that also in that way. Yes.
So, in a way, it's reverse engineering, just like the Russians did reverse engineering. You're going to do reverse engineering. My final set of questions have to do with the theoretical framework, and I'm at a disadvantage here. I have not immersed myself in strategic culture theory the way you have, but my impression is that it's only loosely connected to strategy studies. For example, I find it has something on how to use your strength, your military strength, or in this case, your cyber power, and to how to defend your cyber assets. But it says very little about alliances. I mean, one way of building your power is to create alliances. Another part of strategy could be deception. For obvious reasons, you will not find that in official documents, but I would argue that you could say it's part of Russian strategic culture. So I'm curious to know whether Johnston's theory can tell us something about building alliances. I would say that one of Russia's strategic choices could be to enter into alliances, but this is something that Russia rarely or never does unless it completely dominates an alliance. And then it's not really an alliance. I'm also curious about the other choice, whether to use deception or not. And you quote one article by Polina Sinovets, and she identifies as a behavioral pattern in Russian national security a high level of secretiveness and duplicity, which I would say come close to this issue of deception. And it's not discussed in the thesis for obvious reasons, but because it doesn't appear in the data, but never the same. Could this be an avenue of developing strategic culture theory? It's a question, basically. And just to explore this issue of deception and how very pertinent it is to cyber matters, because cyber is very much an area for the cloak and dagger world. It's where intelligence and security services work. And you write in the thesis, and you mentioned also in your talk, that the USA administration admitted that it had conducted cyberspace exploitation operations in Russian power grid management systems. Well, my question is then, did they really admit to this? Or was it just a US way of saying, you made life difficult for us, we can do the same for you? There might be malware in your systems, there might not. Regardless, Russia will have to check and recheck its entire infrastructure. It might unearth some Chinese spyware there in this process. And even when they've checked all of their systems, they're not sure whether the US has indeed sneaked in malware or not in it. So what are your thoughts on deception and alliance building, and whether strategic culture theory could cover such tactics, techniques, and procedures as well?
No, if we think about the question concerning alliance from the point of view of strategic culture, okay, that might be one of the strategic preferences, so to get alliances. And the Russians, okay, during the Second World War, or the Great Patriotic War, as they call it, they had alliance with UK and United States and so on. And they have, and during the Napoleonic Wars, they had alliance. So they have a long tradition of alliances. And it's one of the strategic preferences. If you think about the cyber environment, they don't have exactly alliances, but as I mentioned, they have some agreements with China and Belarus. But I guess there is not a lot of countries who want, and in a BRICS environment, they are somehow building up some kind of alliances. But it's not so practical. It has not been in a so practical level in cyber environment. So it's one strategic preference, but it has not been implemented except through some cybersecurity arrangements or agreements with some countries. About the deception, yes. If we think about the defensive cyber, the deception is difficult to implement, but if we think, as Matti mentioned that earlier, the offensive cyber, it's part of Russian offensive tactics, the deception. Because the problem of the cyber defense is also attribution. If somebody attack you, you are not able, you might be able to say, okay, it was Russians, or it was Chinese, or it was Americans. But there's always, you never get a full proof that it was that or that organization. And part of deception, Part of complicating the attribution, you can use a deception. For example, if we think about the Bronze Warrior 2007, and there was a lot of attacks, cyber attacks to Estonia. The biggest countries where the attacks came was Egypt, Peru, and Vietnam, and that was not because of those countries were aggressive to Estonia, but those were the countries where the cyber or information security was the lowest one, and the attackers, it was easy to them to take control over computers which were in Egypt and Vietnam and Peru, and even the attacker was a Russian one. The attacks came from Egypt, and that was a part of the deception, I think. And the third question was about the software or the malware in computer networks. I think why United States announced that they have been there in the Russian network since 2012 is related with two things. First of all, it's related with the deterrence. So cyber deterrence is difficult to show, because if we speak about nuclear weapons, you can say, okay, I have this kind of nuclear weapons, I can destroy Moscow and Leningrad and whatever. And the other one believes that, okay, he has a big missiles and he can destroy our cities. We are not able to defense ourselves. But in cyber environment, deterrence is difficult because you can't show that I have a malware like this. Mm-hmm. But you can say that, okay, I have malware in your networks. Mm-hmm. And if you... Because I think the main reason why, two reasons why Americans thought that they are there is, first of all, the Russians have found something in their networks, and the Americans want to tell it earlier before the Russians, because the Americans knew that Russian news knew that Americans are in their networks. And that's why they thought that, okay, we are there. Mm-hmm. And the other one is that they gave warning to Russia, because what is going on, 2020, they have elections, presidential elections, and 2016, the Russians were deeply involved with those elections. So United States is now preparing Russia for 2020 elections in United States by saying that if you are involving our elections, we could cut your electricity totally. Beware.
Yeah.
So I think that's one reason, deterrence.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think there's a strong point to be made that actually cyber measures, they work the best when you threaten to use them rather than when you actually use them. Yeah, I would agree, definitely. Can I go on?
Yes, sir.
I also have a few questions on comparisons with other countries. I know this is not a comparative study. It's a case study. But nevertheless, sometimes I think it's interesting to think about what is unique to Russia. In other words, what makes Russian strategic culture unique compared to other countries? And at times, I think that would strengthen and flesh out your argument. Many countries have rules about VPNs. Many countries allow their authorities to ask ICT companies for traffic details. And in common with many other countries, Russia is still dependent on global cyber infrastructure. I mean, it's very much an American infrastructure that we're dependent upon, not least when it comes to root DNS servers, ICANN, and the routing registry, and so on. And Russia is not alone in developing surveillance technologies for the internet either. So what is special about Russia's way of doing this? Why is the global cyber infrastructure a problem for Russia but not for Sweden or Portugal, or at least not to the same degree? What distinguishes Russia's surveillance of the internet from that which takes place in countries like our own, Sweden and Finland, or other European countries?
No, I think that you had to start from the system of the rule of the country. Because in Russia, it doesn't go like in Finland that, okay, you have elections every 4th year and you get the new parliament and you get the new government and every 6th year get the new president, and we accept it that we go and we elect our leaders and we obey our leaders. In Russia, the system goes in different way. Yeah. When you get up in a hierarchy and you get the position, whatever position it is, the mayor or governor or even higher position, it means that it gives you a possibility to get bribes, mm-hmm. to get money, unofficially get mm-hmm. money. And it tied for your position. If you are mayor, you get more, you get less. If you are government, you get more. If you are president, you get a lot. And you will not be elected every 6th or 4th year. Mm-hmm. If an American sent in internet to us a mail that our president is bad or our government is bad, we say, okay, that might be in that way. But we have elected mm-hmm. them. But because the leadership there in every levels, they try to be eternals. They mm-hmm. they will not to be changed because they lose also the money. Mm-hmm. As Galeotti say, they steal in Russia, they put that in bank in West, in London and so on. So they have a system. So they don't want that somebody is trying to infiltrate either their minds, I mean the minds of normal people, by the internet. So mm-hmm. they try to cut off the all influence which might come from West, as happened in 2011 in Arab Arab countries that the people get information that, okay, there might be a democratic system. The people elect their leaders and they obey the leaders. So the Russians try to keep that in vacuum, the society in vacuum, and they keep them in vacuum, and then they are telling that, okay, we are surrounded by enemies and so on, and if we are not in the lead, we would be in trouble. So that's called guided democracy, or Peskov called it guided democracy.
Yeah, I'm absolutely on board. I would suggest in addition that what is lacking in the Russian system is independent scrutiny. So that we have our in Sweden, our signal intelligence authority has to go through, get scrutinized by a board, and sometimes they're criticized. And the fact that our agency has been criticized a number of times does not mean that it's been violating principles more than the FSB has in Russia. It means that in Russia you have no independent scrutiny of how the FSB behaves. And I'm just raising this point because I think sometimes comparisons will make it more understandable for a reader who's not as familiar as you are with the Russian system, why this is a problem in Russia but not in other countries. Can I go on with one more?
Sure.
This brings me to what strategic culture theory explains or what it allows us to predict in cyberspace. Defense and offensive operations in cyberspace appear to be very much about the business of mistrust and enemies all around everyone. Everything is very opaque, and deception is just an essential part for all the players involved. And so when you outline on page 75 the factors that influence Russia's strategic culture as a sense of vulnerability, fear of surprise, attack and invasion, and feeling like sitting inside a besieged fortress in conditions of permanent war, I think sometimes the head of IT security at major banks and other desirable targets for cyber attacks feel exactly the same. That it is a terrain that is impossible to build durable defenses in. And I know I'm being the devil's advocate here, but does Russia's general strategic culture explain and preordain Russia's threat perception in cyberspace? Or are there conditions in cyberspace that are the same for most countries and IT managers at large corporations?
Yes and no. If we think about the strategic culture, and if we look what Russian behavior in strategic in cyber environment, okay? In Finnish banks, there's attacks also. But we are not thinking about isolate our internet. We are protecting our critical information infrastructure as the Russians do. But we are not thinking about to isolate our internet. Russians are thinking that because according to the theory of strategic culture, they are surrounded by enemies and they had to do that. Okay, we have opposition. I don't know exactly who is now in opposition. But anyhow, in Finland we have opposition, but our government is not blocking the pages, web pages of opposition by telling that, okay, they are including child pornography or they are telling people instructions how to make a suicides or they are not extremist pages and so on. But Russians are doing that because it's part of their strategic culture. The enemy is not only surrounding Russia, but it's also inside. Nemtsov was enemy, now Navalny is enemy, now Navalny web pages are blocked. And so on. So that can be explained. The Russian different behavior, which seems from our point of unrational, it's very rational from Russian point of view if we interpret that through the prism of strategic culture.
Yes. I have one question on proxies and cooperation with criminals in cyber domain. One reason, of course, to the state to cooperate with these criminals is certainly political. The ability to hide behind the cybercrime actors and assume no knowledge or control over their activities. has been vital for, of course, the Russian military thinkers. And one, when we say that strategic deception could easily be accomplished through the use of proxies. Non-state actors can be used by the state overtly or covertly to execute plausible, deniable cyber attacks. And these young hacker patriots are of particular interest in the Russian cyber landscape. Are there mentions of proxies or these hacker patriots in Russian official documents? Because they are, let's say that in my mind, they are almost actors. They are admitting that hacker patriots are almost official. How do you think about that?
No. I was listening to Mark Galeotti last week, and he explained that, okay, the Russians have a system that if they have a hackers over there, and they get caught, the group of hackers get two options. You go to the jail, or you work for us. And if they say, okay, I will work for you, they will be FSB officers or under officers, and they will start to work for FSB. Whole day or half a day. Half day they can work for FSB, make hacking, for example, to states or whatever, and half a day they can do their criminal things, and FSB doesn't touch that anymore. So it's part of that rule by law society that you can very flexible use bad guys for your purposes and let them be in a peace if they obey you. And whatever they do, if they make some bank hacking or whatever, if they don't break your needs or your interests, they can do it. And so the Russians, they have a long tradition for that. And one thing which was mentioned during the 2007 Estonia case was that a young people organization called NASHI was agitating people how to attack Estonia administration and government and so on. They were in NASHI web pages, they were scripts. Copy the script, put that on your browser, and put the address, for example, Estonia government, and push enter, and then you can attack. So even the Russian state was not involved officially in the attack 2007 in Estonia. They didn't deny that. They didn't forbid the attacks. They accepted the attacks made by youngster organizations, NASHI, to the Estonia. So it's not, as I told you, there's no war, there's no peace, there's a lot of things between that. And that's part of the Russian way of operating, because they are thinking in a different way than we are. So they are using criminals, they are using youth organizations to implement the tasks which usually are done by the governmental organizations, like intelligence or military or whatever. Mm.
So it's a part of, in a way, part, so-called official machinery. Mm.
Yeah. Well,
last one.
No, you go.
Okay. Yes, we know all very well that you know very well Finnish system and Western system on this cyber defense issues. And I would like to ask now that what we can learn from Russia handling the cyber domain and cyber issues. For example, when we talk about this kind of whole of government or whole of society approach in Russia, how successful this is, and what we can learn from Russia in our cyber politics or cyber domain.
No, I think in every country there's a discussion about who should protect the country in a cyber environment, and there is no one answer. The Russians, they don't have a. It doesn't go in that way that, okay, military is protecting the country in cyberspace. Even it's protecting the country from the attacks from the air, from the sea, and so on. The cyberspace is different, and they haven't found exactly the solution we don't have a solution who protect this country in a cyber environment. But our solution is the same as the Russians have. There had to be a lot of actors. Somebody had to take care of the critical information infrastructure. Somebody has to take care of the banking and so on and so on. I think that's the most important thing which is familiar with Russia and the Western countries. Americans are thinking who should protect America in a cyber environment, and there is a lot of actors as Russians have also. That might be, even I haven't compared USA and Russia in this thesis, but anyhow, that might be the main point as to your question.
Well, I have one last question that relates to strategic culture theory, and it also brings me back to my questions about actors and the bearers of strategic culture in Russia. In a way, I suppose I'm talking here about what you mentioned in one of the articles as the fourth generation of strategic culture theory, the idea that there are subcultures that vie for influence between themselves. And I'm thinking, could we build an early warning mechanisms about change when it comes to studying Russian cyber? And that's why I think a more thorough discussion of the bearers of strategic culture could be interesting and worthwhile. Alistair Johnston, he writes in an article that there can be multiple cultures, but there's usually a dominating culture. And I think you established in the thesis that the FSB has gradually acquired that dominating role in cyber affairs. So it's interesting to think about what would a weakened role for the FSB lead to, or a strengthened for that matter. How much prediction value do you think strategic culture provides, and under which circumstances do you think change of Russia's strategic culture could occur? Are some elements more resistant to change than other ones? Theory states that state leadership can change strategic culture, but drawing on the discussion on actors earlier, could not a change of leadership lead to a change of strategic culture as well? Is the FSB's dominating role static? Would it change? Can it change and thereby change the Russian strategic culture? And do you think that a more detailed study of the bearers of strategic culture could yield interesting insights and provide early warning for us?
Yeah, I think if we think about the strategic culture, as you mentioned, fourth generation is looking the subcultures. And also Johnston said that, okay, there is subcultures inside of the strategic culture of certain state. But if we speak about Soviet Union and Russia, in Soviet Union it was surrounded fortress or besieged fortress by NATO. 1990s when Russia collapsed or Soviet Union collapsed and the new Russia was born, the new Russia was weak. During the Yeltsin era, there was discussions even that Russia should change. Join NATO. Mm-hmm. Russia and NATO membership was on the table. They discussed about that. The reason was that they were weak. Now we can say that it was tactics. They just get some time to get on their feet again, or they seriously were discussing about the NATO membership of Russia in Russia also. But anyhow, 1990s was the window of opportunities to change the Russian strategic culture. When Putin came to power 2000, the Soviet Union came back. The way of thinking, the Soviet way of thinking came back. West is surrounding us, and enemy is also inside, and so on. So the Russian strategic culture is based mainly on the subculture of power. They call Siloviki. Mm-hmm. Siloviki are in a power, FSB, military, and all other power ministries are in lead. And if we think that Putin is coming from Siloviki apparatus, and he wants to guarantee his safe pension. It means that also the next guy who will be in lead, he will be from the Siloviki apparatus, probably. He had to guarantee the pension of Putin and all the guys who are around him. So probably the Siloviki subculture will be in charge also after 2024 or whenever they change the leader, because, as you mentioned, deception, the Russians are very good in deception. It might be, the change might be not in 2024 elections, might be something else. But anyhow, in lead will be also in the future a guy from Siloviki apparatus. It means that the strategic culture is lead by the subculture of Siloviki. It means that nothing will change. So what they are doing now in a cyber environment, they are doing that in also in the future.
Okay, so we've reached the time for a concluding statement. Distinguished Custis, candidate Kari. This thesis makes an important contribution to the field of research on Russian cyber policy. Future research in this field will need to refer to this thesis. Its main strength is its empirical input rather than the development of theoretical frameworks. Kari has chosen relevant data for his research questions and uses grounded theory method to code the data and to construct categories. He is well acquainted with this methodology and its iterative process. All in all, this thesis delivers on providing a systematic approach to examine Russian cybersecurity policy using mainly primary sources. It constitutes an example of how rigor in selection of the data and a meticulous analysis can provide new knowledge. It is applied and original research, well carried out, and it fills a gap in the literature on Russian cybersecurity. While the thesis adds empirical underpinnings to possible future studies in strategic culture theory, it does not add significantly to generating new or developing existing theory, but nor does it purport to do so. The rewarding discussion we have had here bear witness to the fact that we needed this addition to the body of knowledge on Russian cyber policy. Martti Kari's thesis has made us wiser about Russia's approaches to cybersecurity and the many dilemmas that Moscow faces, but also points to a number of topics that the academic community, as well as Western policymakers, will need to turn their attention to in the near future. We propose to accept the research as a dissertation.
I thank my opponents, thank you for your taking part of this process. Thank you. Ja tämän jälkeen kehotan niitä arvoisia läsnäolijoita, joilla on jotakin muistuttamista väitöskirjani johdosta, pyytämään puheenvuoroa Kustokselta.
Näyttää tilanne sellaiselta, että puheenvuoroja ei ole pyydetty. Kiitän yleisöä. I thank you opponents and audience. Tämä väitöskirja oli historiallinen, nimittäin maisteriohjelma, joka Martti Lehdon johdolla käynnistettiin tässä yli 10 vuotta sitten. Tämä on ensimmäinen väitös alalta ja tiedän, että yleisössä on, tai täällä on 24 kandidaattia nyt odottamassa tämä vastaavallista tilannetta, eli meillä on 25 jatko-opiskelijaa tällä alalla, mikä on hyvin paljon. Tervetuloa uudelleenkin tänne lähetystilaisuuteen ja oikein mukaan, kun tulitte. Meillä on nyt sitten seuraavaksi täällä kahvia. Tämän salin ulkopuolelle voitte sitten haastatella tulevaa tohtoria tässä kahvin yhteydessä. Kiitoksia. Tilaisuus on päättynyt.